This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you by the Friends of the Magic Word. This week, we'd like to welcome two new friends of the Magic Word, Mr. Jay Frazier and Michael Collins. Thank you, Jay, very much for making your monthly pledge. And also, thank you, Mike, for your ongoing pledge, and particularly for you being the first one to make an annual pledge. For the rest of you, let me just mention that this is a brand new feature that Patreon.com now offers. If you are interested in making an annual pledge rather than pledging monthly, that you can do that and receive a discount, but still receive all the same great perks at whatever level of membership that you want to join. So please go over to Patreon.com and there you can check it out. Go to themagicwordpodcast.com and you can go to Become a Friend of the Magic Word. You'll get some information there about why we could use your support. So again, congratulations, Mike, and thank each of you who are the Friends of the Magic Word for your patronage. And thank each of you who are listening this week and every week for coming in and listening. For the last 2 weeks, we've been running a contest for an opportunity for two people to win an autographed copy of Master of Deception by John Ivan Palmer. So stay tuned until after the end of this episode, in which we will announce the names of the two people drawn as winners who will be receiving the two autographed copies of this book. Well, last week we had an interesting conversation with not only one, not two, but three different people. And I also encourage people to leave comments. There is a place at the bottom of each of the blogs in which that you can leave comments. And again, as I said, I encourage you, if you enjoy the podcast or you want other people to know about how that you like that, if you could leave a comment or two. And there was one that we just got this last week I thought I would bring to your attention. It says, many thanks for this exposition on prepping, auditioning, and performing for FISM. I think it may possibly encourage and stimulate others to participate in this global event. And certainly it will immerse us more deeply in the history of magic and its participants, both past and present. And that comment was left by Bob Fitch. So I was very glad to see that Bob was listening to us and that he liked that particular episode. And many of you know who Bob Fitch is, who you should go back and listen. He actually was the subject of an episode we had some years ago. And if you'll just do a search for Bob Fitch in the MagicWordPodcast.com website there, that you'll find him. Highly recommend that. That was a really good one. Anyhow, thank you, Bob, and thank you also for those who participated again last week, and that included Vinnie Grasso, who is a past national president of the Society of American Magicians and also the contest chairman, and Boris Wilde, who is a winner of FISM in a previous year and also currently the head of the jury for the judges, and also for Noel Britton, who is a president of the Magic Circle. And he also gave us some great insight to those who are interested in competing. And it was also after we had finished the recording that Noel had suggested that I might speak to our guest that we have here today, who is a winner of not one, not two, but three different contests that the Magic Circle offers. Edward Hilsum is, again, a three-time or a triple crown winner of the Magic Circle contest, and he also had been touring with some illusionists for a long time and has some really great background and some really interesting stories and also a lot to share when it comes to the contest that he had entered, why he did, and how he prepared for this, and also his goals. And what's interesting is that at 28 years old, he has accomplished so much and has such a bright future ahead of him. So I think you're going to enjoy this week's episode with my guest, Mr. Edward Hilsum, here on The Magic Word. So today I have with me from London, England, someone who is actually a Triple Crown winner. He's someone who's won all three of the awards from the Magic Circle there in London. And we're going to talk about his contest and what's driven him. I think it's going to be fascinating. And I know you guys are going to enjoy my conversation here with my guest, Mr. Edward Hilsum. Hi there, Edward.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you on the podcast episode here today. I was talking with Noel Britton, who is the president of the Magic Circle. He suggested that I might talk with you, and I don't know why I haven't actually before. One is, I guess, because we haven't been really acquainted or introduced, but through Noel we have. And the reason I would like to have talked with you sometime before is because of the awards that you have won. So you had said just before we got on the air over here that there are three different awards that they, I should say, different competitions that the Magic Circle has. Could you describe those again?
Yes, so there's the Stage Magician of the Year, which is obviously for stage magic. There's the Close-Up Magician of the Year. And most recently, the brand new competition, actually, I was the first winner of, which is the Children's Entertainer of the Year.
That's interesting. Now, there's nothing that's necessarily, I mean, you could be a comedy performer, but there's not a comedy category necessarily then within any of those.
No, so comedy magicians obviously can enter those competitions,
right.
But there's not a separate competition for comedy magicians, although the Magic Circle do give out a comedy award annually at mm-hmm. their awards
right.
Evening.
That's kind of what I was thinking then also, that there are so many things I want to unpack as far as working there in England. And you are how old? I'm guessing you're probably, what, 27 or something? Or how old are you?
I'm 28.
28. Okay, there we go. Now let me guess your weight. Guess your age and guess your weight and you win the prize. So obviously, being a young man, you have been involved in magic for a fairly short time as opposed to an old guy like me. And so how did you get, I kind of hate asking these kinds of questions, but because of your path, where it's taken you so far, how did you get started?
Sure, I'll keep it brief. Well, it feels like a long time to me because it's most of my life.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, so I guess like most people, I got the magic set when I was very young. I always remember being fascinated by magic. But I guess the interesting thing for me that put me on a slightly different path was when I was about 7 or 8, I guess, mm-hmm. I remember seeing Lance Burton on TV doing his Dove Magic. And it was only a few seconds. It was in one of those 50 Greatest Magic Tricks type shows.
Right.
I didn't know who he was at the time, but that image just really stayed with me. And although I was practicing card magic and those sorts of beginner tricks that you get in the magic sets, I knew that's what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a few years of really thinking about it, pestering my parents, researching everything I could. There was, you know, we're talking about 12, 13 years ago, so there wasn't actually a lot of information easily accessible back then. And yeah, when I was 15, I think I was 16 when I actually got them, but we set up the aviary, and when I was 16, I got my first dubs. And that was really mm-hmm. the big change, I guess, compared to most magicians that see Lance Burton or get into magic young.
Right.
I very early on started with working with doves and working on an act.
Now, there are obviously other magicians that you had seen, others who have been on TV, and I imagine that he may have been part of another magic special over there or something. Or I remember Paul Daniels and others, I guess, in the UK who you've seen on TV. But it was something about his demeanor, his style, the fact that he was producing doves. What was it that actually captured your attention? I always think that's fascinating. I mean, it's not just the person. Is it the act? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what was it?
It's really tough to think back to that time, because since then I've met him on multiple occasions and I've uh-huh. seen him perform live. But if I was to really try and pin it down at the time, I think it just seemed like real magic to me. There's no other way of putting it. I had mm-hmm. no idea how it worked. I had no idea about method. And to be honest, I didn't really mind. I just loved it. I watched
sure.
it over and over again. And I guess there's no other way of putting it. It just connected with me in a way that no other magic I'd seen at that time had. And I had mm-hmm. seen quite a lot of magic. You know, I guess that special had Copperfield and Penn and Teller, and I'd seen, I think Derren Brown was around back then. And, you know, I loved all those performers, but there was just something about that classical style mm-hmm. without words or performed to music that connected with me in a way that the other styles didn't.
Right. Yeah, that is interesting because I can point to different people that I have seen perform, and they do something that I think that is magic. You know, I mean, I don't have any explanation. I don't know how this possibly could have been done. Seeing someone perform, John Cornelius had done some things that's like, that's just impossible. Or Michael Weber, you know, some people, it's just, it's like, I thought I had a good idea about how some magic was done. But this was later in my career, whenever I saw people, it's still, I still love to be fooled and to not know methods or see something that's astounding and mystical to me. It's interesting also that you thought you'd get like into doves and everything, because that's not something that a lot of people get into. You were talking about cards, and that makes sense because particularly as a young person that where you have limited income, and so you can afford some cards, but to have an aviary, like you said, to actually have the doves and practice with them, and then the music and this, everything else, I think that would be something more expensive, and it's an interesting course that you took.
Do you know what? There was another element you just mentioned that I think was a big factor, is that I'd never seen anyone do dove magic live. You know, so when I was growing up, I was a member of the Young Magicians Club from the age of 10. I was going to the Magic Circle. So that's a society for young magicians between 10 and 18 at the Magic Circle. So they meet once a month. So I was going to the Magic Circle from a young age, seeing a lot of magic, but I'd never seen that style of magic live. So I think that perhaps is why it connected with me even more when I saw it on TV, because I just wasn't aware that it was even a thing.
Even a thing. Yeah, I understand. No, there are not a lot of dove magicians around. I mean, it seems like you can, as far as those who are at the pinnacle of their career, there are just a handful of people that kind of come to mind that would be contemporaries, basically. Some people have been around, Channing Pollock and others, you know, in the past, and Shimada. But as far as new people, you know, James DeMare. And, well, it's interesting, you know, that I was thinking about Johnny Ace Palmer, who also uses they produced dove going close up even then too. It's interesting that Lance is one of the few people. So it's just, there's a lot to that. Now, in keeping the doves, did you say you built an aviary in your backyard? Your dad helped you or something, or how did, what did you do as far as acquiring the doves? How did you get involved with that?
So I could probably speak for hours just on this. It was really just researching it. So I found an aviary builder, because it's quite a specialized thing, you know. I'm not the best at making things myself, and I knew that if we're going to have animals, their safety was paramount, obviously. So who's best at building aviaries? Well, someone that does it for a living. So yeah, I contacted someone who actually specializes in that, and a local builder helped with the whole project. So building the foundation, it was a base, a concrete base, and I also had a shed to practice in initially. I outgrew the shed eventually, but I set some lights up in the shed, and so that's where I started training the doves to fly and flight train them. And I used to rehearse my act in there every day, and next door was the aviary, and that's where they enjoyed flying. And
well, as they developed, then you said that you were working then in the shed where you were rehearsing. Then I assume that eventually you brought them into the house and started rehearsing inside. And I imagine your mom and dad didn't care for that a lot.
I'm really lucky. My family are so supportive. I mean, even back then, taking over the garden, which I pretty much did for the aviary. And then it was more as it got into winter, it got colder, quite damp. And I got some more expensive props that I didn't really want to keep in the shed. So it just made sense to me. And my family didn't say no. And I quickly turned our lovely lounge into a confetti area with little singe marks from the matches. You can imagine. But
yes, I can.
I'm very lucky to have been able to do that.
Yep. I used to do dove magic. I have done a little bit of everything, and I had an aviary also that I'd built. And then alongside the cage is I had a place for my rabbit. And so I had the rabbit over there, and then the aviary that was next to it in the backyard. But our temperature, our climate is a little bit more temperate over here. I know that you have some pretty dreek days, you know, that they're very cold and rainy. And so did you eventually bring them into the house and then leave them there, or put them in the shed?
So I've got a new aviary now, but the original aviary, I did actually put heating in there in the sheltered area. Made sure it was completely shut off, like covered from the elements. But after speaking to some vets, I've got a very good vet locally, and he told me they're fine all year round. The only thing that where I am, I need to worry about is the water freezing, because the lowest it goes to is -2, -3.
Mm-hmm.
And so the doves themselves are fine in that temperature. It's just, obviously, if the water freezes, they can't physically get a drink. So that's the only thing that I've had to be aware of. You know, I was obviously worried the first few years of when it was so cold, but the doves are absolutely fine. They, because it's, you know, it doesn't suddenly go from 20 degrees to, I'm talking Celsius.
There's not like a cold snap.
It doesn't suddenly go from warm to minus. So they're amazing. They're very hardy, and as long as they're looked after, they're...
Do you have still some of the same doves today that you'd had 10 years ago?
I do, yeah. My oldest dove is 13.
Okay.
Yeah, so
Have you named him?
The beginning, yeah.
You named it?
They all have names, yeah. That dove is named Kadabra.
Kadabra, okay.
Yeah.
So tell me, how many doves and what are their names?
I have 14 doves. I won't go through all the names.
Wow,
but,
okay.
Named after just friends, heroes of mine, and names that are all right.
Sure. Do they respond to you? Whenever you call their name, or you know them? Who they are?
They don't respond to name, no, but they do certainly have personalities. I'm sure you've experienced with your doves that they are all different. And
that's true.
I've got some doves that are extremely affectionate and some that are just very docile. You know, they're different, and that's part of the joy. They're my little family.
That's right. Yep. Speaking of which, on a family that I only wanted so many doves, and they kept laying all the time. And so my wife would go out regularly in the aviary, and what you say is just do an abortion. She'd take the eggs and just throw them against the fence. It's like, I don't want these anymore.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Anymore. So as soon as she saw that they were sitting, she'd move them aside and pick up their eggs and dash them. So we didn't have any more than what we actually needed, because we knew they're going to be living for a long time. I know that another thing, the handling with doves, that is living with doves, that they can have dove dust, which can get in your lungs. Mm-hmm. And I go back to David Oliver here in the U.S., over in Boston, Massachusetts area, who had to have lung replacement. And he had a big article that's been in Gene Magazine and elsewhere about his issue. And I know others who have had some issue with that. Regardless of how clean that you might keep them, that they're still going to be having this dust if you live with them 24/7. So that's why it's good, I guess, that you have an aviary outside, that they're not in your house. You're familiar with that?
Yes, and I heard of that. I was warned, I think, before I heard of David's particular story. But that's when it really hit home that, you know, it's wise to keep them outside, and I'm lucky I'm in an area where I can. But also, I don't think I did before, but when I became aware that it is such a serious problem, every time I'm in there for any length of time, I wear a pretty serious mask. I switch from disposable mask to a pretty heavy duty one. And it's something that also I was very aware of. I've toured a lot around the UK and a little bit in America with the birds. And even when I'm in a dressing room for a long time, when we can, I always try to have the doves in a separate room to the room I'm in for the majority of the time. And I think just being aware that that is potentially an issue, helps you prepare for it.
Yeah, that's a good point. You touch on another area, and that has to do with the places where you can perform that, which is another thing. You know, where you're doing as a young person, and you can only afford cards, but then you decide to get some doves. It's the venues of where you're going to be able to find to perform. In other words, that you can find more places, whether it's going to be a corporate cocktail strolling or restaurant or pub or whatever, and doing some close-up stuff. But doves is a stage act with music, typically, and something that requires lighting and everything else. So you're kind of limited to the number of shows that you would do. I mean, you can rehearse all that you want for a month for the one show you're going to do or something, if you can't find the right venue. Have there been, or are there a lot of venues in and around the UK? You said that you had toured around there plus come to America. What kind of places do you perform?
So it's varied, really. As a young performer, when I was getting started, certainly I would just say yes to everything because I wanted to perform, and I would be taking my doves to places that I just wouldn't consider now. Like, I would do comedy clubs where,
oh really,
you know, an evening of comedians, and I would be doing my dove acts.
Was
right?
it a serious
so it
dove act?
Normally a nightmare venue.
I mean, did you have comedy in the act?
No, it's not. It's certainly not a comedy act. It would be more of a variety act.
I was going to say it's a bit of a variety
act.
Yeah.
It was more when, I guess, producers saw what I did, especially as a young performer, they wanted it in their shows because it was so different. I had never seen it live, and I guess the same with these, you know, bookers. And I would just say yes to everything, and it led to some amazing opportunities. I met wonderful people.
Sure.
And it was from those shows, and I've got to say, from doing competitions, that people sort of associated me with the Dove Act, and that's how I got on this touring show called Champions of Magic, which you may have seen.
Oh, sure.
Advertised. So I was in the very first show with them, and I toured with them for just over 5 years before I decided to pursue other avenues. And before that show came along, I was at university, and I'd sort of started developing other magic other than the doves, because I wanted to perform magic and I didn't have the doves with me. And it just felt like the right time also. I was close to really stopping the Dove Act, because I realized I didn't want to perform it in venues where I had to get ready in a toilet and, you know,
didn't have a proper dressing room.
It wasn't really comfy for me. It wasn't comfy for the doves. You know, I got to a stage where I was comfy performing. I didn't need to just perform for the experience. So at that time, that's when Champions of Magic came along, which it was just perfect timing, because it gave me theatres to perform in, to rehearse in. That's when I started really training them to fly back, because until you are working regularly, I think, you know, it's one thing training the doves at home, but it's another thing when you're in a 1,000, 2,000 seat theatre with proper lights. And that's when my act and I think my magic altogether went to another level.
Well, yeah, I understand. And that you can rehearse all that you want, but until you actually get in that theatrical situation, that it's going to be completely different than what you're practicing in your shed or, you know, or your home or whatever. I recall when, speaking of Lance Burton again, that he had won back in Nashville back in the 1970s when he was the first person to win the gold medal for the International Brotherhood of Magicians. When they had their band call, when they had the rehearsal in the afternoon before the evening contest, I was talking with someone backstage later, and they were talking about how that he had stayed there and practiced throwing his doves into the spotlight so that way that they would get used to flying back. And he was there for, I don't know, I want to say like 2 hours, but I don't know whether that realistic. You know, it's kind of one of those legends. It may or may not have been, but for some period of time that he wanted to make sure that the doves were comfortable in the larger theater and were coming back. I've worked with Amos Lefkovich a lot in the past here in Houston, the Magic Island. He used to come and work, and then we got to be good friends. And I've seen him work in so many different venues as well, where, as you know, at the end that he has this coop of doves that is released from where the spotlights are.
Incredible.
He holds out his arms and they all land, and it's just, yeah, it's an incredible, incredible act. But he was very cautious, conscientious, and caring for his doves. I remember when we were here at the Magic Island, we'd go out for breakfast like at 2 a.m. or something, and he would have his doves in my car, and he would go out 2 or 3 times from the restaurant to check to make sure that they were okay and the car hadn't been broken into, because that was his living. That's not just, and to him, as you were talking about, their family. The people have to recognize if they're going to work with doves that they're making a huge commitment. It's not like a deck of cards that you can buy another deck. You know, it is not a human being, but it is a living creature that you need to care for and recognize that they do need care. You were smart. You mentioned you have a veterinarian to take care of them as well. I think you do need to have that, just like you have your own medical doctor who takes care of you. You have to make sure that you have something, that you have your birds taken care of, or your rabbit, or whatever the animals that you're working with. So good on you. You had also a great venue to work with in the Champions of Magic then for a few years then too.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think just to touch on the care, I think it's so vital that if you have animals in your act, that, you know, that's the number one priority, you know, that you care for them. And to me, it was just, you know, it just felt like the obvious thing that if I was worried about an issue with a dove, that I'd speak to a vet. It wasn't something that really crossed my mind as being unusual until I met some other magicians with animals that perhaps don't think of their animals like that. So I think it's naturally the way I have been with them, but I think being aware that not everyone is like that, I think it's just worth mentioning, you know, that if you don't genuinely care for the animals, I think it not only does it come across to the audience,
it does.
I think there's no hiding it. You know, you can't fake that relationship. And, you know, people often ask me, isn't it outdated working with animals, or, you know, audiences don't want to see it? I do disagree, because I think when it's performed with respect and love for the animals, I think audiences enjoy it. And I've had many audience members say, I don't like Animal Acts, but you know, what you did felt different, or words to that effect.
And, that's nice.
Yeah, I'm not naive to the fact that there may be some people in that audience that don't like it, but maybe don't come up to me. But I think there's a big difference between genuinely caring for the animals and pretending.
And pretend, you're exactly right.
Yeah.
That goes back to a kind of show how old I am, that I was before the first time I'd worked at the Magic Castle, and Bill Larson said, I got something from the SPCA, the Society for the Preservation of, what is that, Protection of Animals Rights, Animal Rights Association, years ago. I used to go by the name, stage name of Great Scott. And he said that someone had written saying to the SPCA that Great Scott was on the Azure Seas cruise ship, and one of the passengers had said that Great Scott was mishandling the doves and want to find out if you are that Great Scott. And I wrote back and I sent a picture and I said, no, you know, here's my promo picture. You know, this is me. We've never been on the Azure Seas, not me. And so anyhow, I ended up working this fine, but I had to prove to Bill Larson that it was not me. And I later found out who this person was, and also a little bit more detail, apparently that this passenger had seen the way that the doves had been stuffed into a box or a cage and were dirty. They were in a dirty area. Just, it didn't look like they were being cared for properly, and what this person was complaining about. So my point is, I think that people do notice whether that you are showing a genuine love for your animals, the way that you handle and treat them and care for them, not only during the show, but also after the show, that they can, particularly on a cruise ship where they can see you, you know, on a daily basis, to make sure that you are continuing your respect. And that's not just something that you feign while you're on stage. That really is you. And this person wasn't at the time. So anyhow, it's kind of a interesting backstory. Do you ever receive then after a show, or did you, when you were doing this with the Champions of Magic, when they were coming and saying that they loved the show, but anybody was saying it didn't like the way that you were handling or using animals? Because I know that there, I mentioned the SPCA, but also PETA, the People Eating Tasty Animals, or whatever that stands for, that they also are complaining about people using animals like wild tigers and whatever else in magic shows. Has anybody come to you and said, oh, you know, you shouldn't be using doves?
No, honestly, I never did. And I even asked the producer, and he said, no, there was not one complaint. You know, like I say, I'm not naive to the fact that people might be thinking negatively about it, but I never had anyone, you know, in all my years doing this, I've never had anyone say they didn't like it or felt like I was mistreating the animals. No, I've had a few people just ask, like, inquire, are the, you know, because the doves vanish at the end of my act, just saying, are they, you know, sort of hinting, are they okay? Like, but a bit tongue in cheek, you know, you sometimes get that sort of comment, people wanting to meet the doves, but no, I've never. It's quite surprising, really, I guess, but no, I've
that's
never
why I was asking,
negative.
You know, in today's society, you know, about how that some people are very overprotective about, I say, rightly so, you know, protective of animal rights and want to make sure that they're handled properly. And I guess they can probably see the way that you are handling them with such respect that there's no issue nor question nor complaints. That's great. So have you actually been training or teaching other people about dove magic?
Yeah, part of the joy of it is, you know, as I was performing in bigger shows, that more people saw me, and I had some magicians come up to me and ask for advice, and I was always very happy. And there's a couple of young magicians I'm mentoring at the moment, but yeah, and also older magicians, people older than me that are interested, that because my doves breed, quite a few magicians have my doves, and well, doves that were bred in my aviary. And I feel very fortunate to be able to give back to the community, and I'm always very happy to help. And especially, you know, looking back to when I didn't know much about dove magic, it's nice to be able to pass that on, the things I've learned. And, you know, I've been very fortunate to get to know many of my heroes, and they've been extremely generous for their time. So just feels only right that I do the same. And I think it's just a great joy in, you know, seeing others grow, and it makes you a better performer and person in general, I think.
Good point. Have you created anything or invented, like, your own harness or some sort of a dove production or vanish or something? Or Have you used just some standard things? I say standard things that I'm sure has got your own twist and everything on that that makes it unique. But has there been anything that you feel that you have invented or created that no one else has done before?
That's really tough. I think everything in my act, I've sort of put my own touch on. You know, there's some classic effects, but certainly in terms of the methods, there's nothing that I just bought and used. Everything is a combination of methods, or I guess a few of my own touches, but I don't really think too much about, did I create this or mm-hmm. is this someone else's? You know, as long as it's as magical as possible, that's sort of my goal. So there may be a few original things that I do and mm-hmm. the original techniques, but the quick answer is I'm not sure.
Well, then how do you go about, you kind of touched on that a minute there, how do you go about creating the act? What is it that you are looking for? You're looking for mysterious moments or something that's a little bit different. What, I mean, do you, you say you have 14 doves. I mean, you're not going to be producing 14 no. doves in the course of an act, I know. How do you put that together and decide when is the right moment in order to create that surprise? And how do you create your act?
So to be honest, the core act was pretty much the same as I was doing when I was 16, so back mm-hmm. in 2007. So if I think back to that, I was just inspired by, you know, I'd watch as much as I can and look at sequences. I always remember thinking about it theatrically. I wanted it to flow, so I wanted it to fit with the music, but I also wanted it to flow from one effect into another. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky to have mentors that helped me with that side of things, that taught me about theatricality. I had a director from a very young age, a theatrical director who helped me with the movement, and that was always important together with the magic. But in terms of creating the surprise, I think I just learned from watching mm-hmm. people that did it best, watching, you know, Lance right. Burton, Channing Pollock, Johnny Thompson, Amos, right. And later Marco Carvo was a huge influence on me. But yeah, to think about it recently, because I haven't really developed that back a lot, I'm happy to say, over the last few years, because I've been focusing on this other side of magic,
yes,
the patter side and doing full theatre shows. But the last time I really developed the Dovac was just before the stage competition. Mm-hmm. And that was thinking about it more theatrically to really improve some of the big niggles I've had. Because when you're touring, you know, you think you've got so much time, but actually there's not a lot of time to adapt and change things. So I had a big list of to-dos that I just kept putting off. And then right. the stage competition at the Magic Circle I'm talking about, which was 2018, the few months before that, I had just left Champions of Magic. So I took that 6 months or so to really develop and work on some what felt like big changes to me, like changing one of the tables, changing some of the moments, making it stronger theatrically. And I guess I wouldn't have known that those things needed work without kind of quite a few years of experience doing the act, watching it back and really thinking about what can be better here.
Right, right. So you developed a completely different act or just made some tweaks to your existing act compete?
It was pretty, you know, I can watch a video of my act from 2007 and mm-hmm. it still has elements, you know, of
sure.
the act. There's still chunks of magic that are pretty similar, you know, I've refined them, but it was more like I talk about changing a table, which doesn't sound like much, but you know, every ditch, every still is a little bit different. The movement, mm-hmm. everything in my act is choreographed to the music. So there's actually quite a lot of movement that I've learned over the last 10 years that I had to unlearn and reteach myself, which really took a while. But it was a fun journey to have and to finally make those things better.
Do you change your music also? I would think it would need to be contemporary. For an example, whenever I watch some classic acts from the past, mm-hmm. let's say like Mr. Electric, he'd use the same music from the 70s yeah. all the way through to the 2000s. It never really changed. So it was a classic act because of the classic music that it turned out to be. But do you change your music every year or so?
So this was part of the joy of being involved in a production, you know, as a magician with a solo act, it was always pretty much my decisions. You know, my mentors would help me find some music, but my act pretty much had the same music for the first 10 years. And then the producer of the Champions of Magic show very delicately eventually asked, can you consider changing something? And you know, he was spot on. It was by that time I picked you know, the music I liked when I started, which
sure.
was, you know, 90s, early 2000s music, and it was a bit out of date.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so I changed most of the music while I was on tour, and then I'm actually starting to redo the app now. And I have just, I'm looking at changing all the music over again. So yes, to answer your question, it is something that I think is very important to keep the music up to date.
It is. It seems like that you have a current act if you have current music as well, as opposed to having yeah. something that's going to be dated, as I was just mentioning earlier. In that case, do you have issues then with ASCAP or trying to pay royalties for music, or do you have music that is written for you?
So the only issue, so no, I don't have music written for me. That is something I'm looking at in the near future. But right now, and up to date, I've used recorded music. And in live venues, we have PRS, which is sort of just a license fee that gets paid mm-hmm. to.
Is it paid by the theater, or is it paid by you, or who pays them?
It varies. So it's either the venue or the production or
the booker,
you, depending on mm-hmm. yeah, or the act, depending on the environment. But the only issue is sometimes if you're uploading things online, that, you know, YouTube might reject it if it's contains some copyrighted music, or it would put adverts. But no, I've it's something I'm looking at getting music made, because that's obviously the best way.
Sure.
Music written for me, but right now I'm still blocking in and working out the feeling of different parts, and then the next stage will be. Yeah.
Because that's what I've noticed. For an example, let's say like it's running in the U.S. right now, Masters of Illusion, that's produced by Gay Blackstone. Well, none of the music is commercial, something that they probably have to pay a lot of royalty rights for. But they often have music that sounds like something else. In other words, I'll just use an example. Let's say like John Barry's music from 007, bum ba da dum bum 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 ba da dum bum. You know, so you know what that's going to be. But if you change that a little bit, it still maybe sounds like bum ba da dum bum 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 or whatever. That it would still have a sure. little bit in the back of your mind, but they would get past the having to pay royalties for that. So that's what I'm saying. Whenever you're going to be having some music that's eventually going to be made for yourself, that way that YouTube's not going to bump that off either. I know exactly what you're saying. I've had the same thing. So of mine,
yeah.
they're saying, hey, this is copyrighted music, and so you can't monetize this, and then, you know, et cetera. So fine, but you have to recognize that, you know, whenever that you're putting that together. Well, I assume that is something you've spent a lot of time doing, but then you apparently must have been doing a lot of birthday parties to be a children's entertainer and to have won the Children's Entertainer Award. So tell me a little bit about the background on that. That's a whole different subject, I assume.
To be honest, I've probably done 3 children's parties in my life.
Oh, my goodness.
I wouldn't consider myself would not have expected a children's
that.
Entertainer, but I will explain the story. So
okay.
I've had 2 one-hour theatre shows, which I created for the Edinburgh Festival, Fringe Festival.
Fringe.
The first one was in 2015. It was called Genie, and that was a show where I granted 3 wishes to members of the audience. And that was a family show.
Mm-hmm.
So children were involved in elements and adults were involved in elements, but it wasn't a kids show. And then my second show last year was called Silver, and it was more of an adult show, but it was still a family friendly show, so it certainly wasn't tailored for the children.
Yes.
But children could come and enjoy it with the adults.
Mm-hmm.
And in both of those shows there were routines. Actually, in Silver is probably a better example. There was just one element that I performed with a child, and it was probably the strongest part of the show. I think everyone watching would probably agree with that. And the child was only on stage for probably 5 minutes altogether, mm-hmm. one part towards the beginning and then a little moment at the end. And I realized that, you know, those moments could go together with another element I had in Genie, and I'd have an act. So when I saw the Children's Entertainer of the Year, I knew, okay, I'm not a generic children's entertainer, but I know I have material that works for children's audiences.
Mm-hmm.
So I put those together, and yeah, that's how that came to be. So I can talk more about that if it's of interest of the material, but just to explain that, although I'm not a children's entertainer, I knew my magic would work in that environment.
That's interesting. Now, the contest itself, would you have 10, 12, 15 minutes? What was the timeline that you had to compete?
It was a maximum of 12 minutes, a hard 12 minutes, I seem to remember. I can't remember if there was a minimum, but it probably was. I think it was 10 to 12. Mm-hmm. And the reason I entered the competition, well, firstly, it was a deadline. I'm a big fan of deadlines to improve mm-hmm. for and to stretch myself for. But also I realized it was not a children's party. It was held at the Magic Circle. It was a theater show. And
there were children in attendance, I assume.
There were children in attendance, but they were sat with their parents. You know, it wasn't a group of 50 children on the floor. Hmm. I was on stage, you know, so all those things that would terrify me about a children's party of, you know, keeping the children
of
occupied and sat down and all those things, I knew would not be an issue. The curtains would open and I would do my act. So that was home to me. That feels like second nature, especially at the Magic Circle. So, I invited one child up on stage to mm-hmm. do most of the act, but it was a theatre act in my mind, and with magic that works for family audiences.
Yeah, something that you'd already used, and so you took a couple of pieces and put that together. So you probably just had, a couple of different effects? I mean, within a 12-minute period, you wouldn't have too many things you could do.
Exactly. So I can tell you what I did. I did a Miser's Dream routine. So my shows are quite stories, quite narrative led. So actually, it started with me telling the story of how I got into magic, and I won't go into that, but I had to cut that really down to fit mm-hmm. into the 12 minutes because...
So it was different from the story you just told us about Lance Burton and watching TV. You had a different fabricated story, I assume, that sounded great for stage.
Well, no, the Lance Burton isn't the reason I got into magic. There was, I talk about the first time I remember seeing magic.
Okay.
Was a coin, the feeling of a coin coming out of my ear. So, to go back to the Lance Burton thing, I think that was the sort of, what I realized you could do as a magician.
Okay, kind of a light bulb moment, yeah.
Yeah. So,
So you did the Miser's Dream, and then what else?
Miser's Dream, and then... the ending of my first genie, which is a magician's assistant type routine where I put a jacket on the child.
Yes.
And my arms through the jacket, and it looks like the child's doing the magic. And actually, talking to Lance Burton, there's a lovely connection there, because as we were coming up with the ending for my first show, I knew I wanted a child to become the star of the show, and I wanted the child to really do magic and the audience give them a round of applause. And we're thinking, what can they do? And I kept coming back to Lance Burton's routine I saw him do with, that type of routine mm-hmm. where you put the jacket over the child, and he used to do part of his dove act. And I remembered it so vividly, but I kept thinking, well, I can't do it. It's Lance's. And my good friend James Friedman, who I collaborated a lot with, said, well, why don't you just ask Lance mm-hmm. for permission? So I did ask him for permission to do something based on the blocking of his routine, and amazingly he granted me his permission. So
he's a great guy. Yeah
lovely guy, and extremely grateful for that. So that came direct, my version of that routine, which finished with the child producing a dove mm-hmm. and then there's a lovely callback where I pass something on to the child, and there's a impossible moment of magic with that mm-hmm. and that's
that. And so that's what won you that year for the children's. That wasn't the same year that you had won. I assume each of these three trophies that you won were in separate years.
Just by the nature of when the competitions are, yes. So the Stage Magician of the Year was 2018. The Children's Entertainer was 2019. And then the Close-Up Competition, 2020.
Now let's move on then to Close-Up Competition. So obviously you had an interest in cards for a long time, because you were talking about that before you kind of got into doves, because you had cards. So you maintained that interest all along, so you're always kind of fiddling with cards?
Do you know, I started with cards and coins. I think it's the natural sort of starting point, isn't it? You start with Close-Up Magic. It's the easiest to get into. There's lots out there. But I don't really perform a lot of card magic, actually. It's something I didn't really realize until a reviewer posted it after my show in Edinburgh, saying in hindsight, one of the more unusual aspects is you might not realize that you've just seen an hour of magic without any cards or mentalism.
Hmm.
which was, I think wasn't a conscious effort. It's just I've always liked things that are a bit different and to try and do things a bit differently. And
good for you.
In both my shows, there was not one card trick in 2 hours of stage magic, which is quite nice. So the close-up competition I actually treated as, right, I should say my show, my last show I did in Edinburgh, Silver, was a very intimate show on purpose. So coming from performing for 2,000 people upwards with the Champions of Magic show, I sort of became a bit disillusioned with that and felt like it became very difficult to connect with that, those audiences. You know, yes. I felt like a lot of polite energy, especially performing with the Doves and, you know, really in relation to some of the other magic, the illusions in the show, quite small scale magic. And I just wanted to be able to perform without a video screen. So my audience in Edinburgh, it was a small 50-seat room, and it was probably my most enjoyable time as a magician performing for those audiences. It was strong magic that really connected and the audience were part of. And
you're lucky to have found a good-sized venue up there, because I know how difficult it is with so many thousands of people trying to find a venue. And a 50-seat theater sounds like that'd be ideal.
So it wasn't even a theatre. It was a basement room underneath the, there's not really any theatres in the Edinburgh Festival, but it was just perfect for my show. With a tiny 3x1 meter stage, there was just no disconnect with the audience. I was there in the audience really from the beginning. And so I realised, so the pieces I performed in the close-up competition were from that show. So they were really developed as stage pieces, but I knew they worked with very close audience.
Right.
That makes sense. So what I did probably wasn't stereotypically wouldn't be known by magicians as close-up magic.
It's more stand-up
magic
kind of
that
thing.
Works in
parlor
in that environment.
Well, if you weren't doing cards, let me ask you, within that 12-minute period, what were you doing? And it wasn't cards and mentalism. What did you, I assume coins?
Yes. So I created a coin routine quite a few years ago called Silver, which gave its name to the full show, that I'm really proud of. So that's a coin routine performed to music, and I bring one person from the audience up on stage to experience it right up close. And then there was another piece of magic that I developed for the show, which is really interesting. It's I show a photo in a frame. I'm trying to dissect this for you without telling you the full presentation, but it's basically based on the importance of memories and checking in on our memories. And I show a photo that I had forgotten about that meant a lot to me. And then I ask everyone in the audience to open their phones and flick through their photos, find one they've forgotten they had.
Yeah.
So everyone finds these forgotten photos, thinks back to these times. And I pick someone, they join me. I do some magic with my photo. It gets torn up, restored impossibly. They then take the empty frame. I say, think back to your memory. And they open their hands, and inside the empty frame is now their photo that they were thinking of.
Wow, that was from their phone.
And so it's a really powerful moment. And I stripped that back for the close-up competition because I didn't have time to do the full presentation. So it became, actually, I pulled my photo out of my phone. I added that for the close-up competition to have a quick bit of magic at the beginning.
Yeah.
Showed that photo, brought someone up who had a memory in mind, performed Silver the coin routine, and then put my photo in their hands. They opened their hand, and in their hands, my photo had changed into their photo.
To their photo. Lovely.
And they get to keep that.
Brilliant.
So that was the full act.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that time limit was just 8 minutes, so it was a real challenge to get it into that time. But
yes.
it was a fun journey, and I got that.
Well, the natural progression, I would think, having won each of those competitions at such a prestigious level at the Magic Circle, do you have visions for long term of competing and going to the Continental World Championships, taking you ultimately to FISM? Is that something in the back of your mind you're thinking about?
Yes. So. It wasn't, and then talking about those two pieces of magic, the silver coin routine and the photo routine, I didn't really realize it until after the competition, when people were asking me about the competitions, as you have, that actually those two pieces are original with me, and I'm really proud of them, and I'm still developing them. So I do feel like that is certainly an act that is sort of
FISM worthy.
Not FISM level, but yeah, I guess I'm on the way to being a FISM. So I did enter this year the FISM European Championships, and unfortunately they've been postponed to next year. But I've also, as I said, I like a deadline because I was going anyway. I entered with my Dove act in the stage competition.
For the Continental Championships?
That's right.
Okay, so you're going to be entering in two different categories?
Yes, so I am entering the stage and the close-up.
Okay. Would that be called micro magic or not? I think that, you know...
So under... I am... it's parlor magic under the close-up.
Okay.
I think that is a... yeah.
I know they have subcategories.
Yes, it was a while ago since I did the form, but I felt parlor magic, yeah, is basically, as I took it, intimate stage magic, which is what that act is best suited for.
So that's going to be in 2021 when they have the Continental, the European Championships.
Where
do you go to compete? Or would it be locally and they kind of, the judges come around and just judge in your area? Or do you all show up at one place, like in Madrid or someplace? Or where will it be?
No. It's in Spain, yeah, close to Barcelona, and yeah, that's why, you know, it's been postponed, because it is everyone getting together in one place and traveling together. So yeah, I was really excited to, you know, I felt like I built up some momentum at the beginning of this year, but of course, you know, it's for good reason to be postponed, and gives me some more time to prepare, especially with the Dove Act. There's quite a few changes that I'm working on, and yeah, looking forward to finally getting out and
well, good luck. That really sounds great. So what is your long-term plan? I mean, being a young gentleman at 28, and you have done a lot of and accomplished so much that people who are twice your age would come close to. What are your 5, 10, 15, 30-year plan? I mean, where do you see yourself like 5, 10 years from now? What do you want to have achieved?
Yeah, that's really tough. You know, I try not to look too far ahead.
Oh, you should.
I stay positive at doing what I'm doing. But,
especially if you like deadlines.
Yeah, I really enjoy the magic I'm doing right now. The magic that is in my new show that I debuted last year. Yeah, I hope I had some opportunities lined up this year that I hope will, you know, roll over to next year. And I just really want to perform more of that. So long term, I would just love to be able to perform my show. So in any way, shape or form, really, you know, that show also was on purpose created to be quite low maintenance, if that makes sense.
Like, sure,
not
yeah.
Going from the Dove Act, which needed all the tech and couldn't really travel with internationally. This new show is very travel friendly and more about the story and the narrative and the performance than the physical props.
Well, that's why I was wondering if, you know, in the long term, you were actually looking to have something that you would have as a steady venue, some place that you would continue to go back to on a regular basis, as opposed to touring, because you've done touring shows. And so I don't know, or whether it might be on television or to have your own series or something, or perhaps, again, coming to the States and working in Vegas or having something. I just didn't know if there was a long-term plan that you have that would be ideal. I mean, if you talk about your show called Genie, Making a Wish, what your wish might be.
I guess the dream would be to have my own venue where I could perform, show, and create an experience for audiences. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really love performing in America. It was a stressful time I had to borrow birds. I will not go into that, but it was...
I was wondering,
you know,
whether
my doves...
You'd have to quarantine or couldn't bring your doves in.
Yeah, we looked at it, and it just, you know, I was really worried with the risks of, you know, I've never, my doves have never flown as, you know, they basically go as cargo. And, yeah, I just wasn't really too keen on that idea. And yeah, that was a whole challenge in itself, not having my doves. And it felt like going back a step because I just trained them to fly, etc.
Yeah.
So I would love to come back to America. And yeah, I guess, you know, I have toured, but I feel like if I could do something new on tour, it would be exciting again. You know, I did enjoy touring. So I wouldn't say no to, you know, opportunity that came along. But I think the dream really would be to have somewhere where I could do my show. But even if that was, you know, touring or doing something else, I would, I think I'd be happy as long as I'm performing.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Again, let's say that in a perfect world and that you won FISM Grand Prix, let's say, you know, in your imagination that you had won that, where would you hope to go from there?
Well, do you know, I think what winning competitions has taught me is that they don't entitle you to anything, right?
That's a good point. Nope,
As a, you know, I feel like I am still a young magician. As a younger magician, I remember thinking, you win a competition and the world's your oyster, you know, everything gets delivered to you. But I think what's more important is ending up with an act that people want, right? So I've become friends with Marco Carver, who won the first place at FISM in 2012. But before that, he was already probably the most in-demand bird act in the world. You know, his diary was full for the next 6 years at one time. He's has his choice of venues and he's performing. You know, the FISM competition was more ticking a box.
Yeah,
and it was a lovely box to tick, but you know, I can tell you the trophies are on the top shelf in his living room. He doesn't look at them. It's not important to him, and what's important is working and still improving the act. I think if I got to that stage one day where I did do well at FISM, I think that's just a sign that I've got an act that's worth that people want to see, you know. So I think that is where I would love to end up, is having an act that is busy and I'm performing and sharing with people.
Well, that's the attitude of a true performer. When I think of people, let's say, who have won Grammys, or they have because they just want to continue with their music and to perform someplace else. It's like, yeah, they've got all these nice trophies, but they can put them on the shelf. The same thing with actors that can put their BAFTAs or their Emmys or Academy Award Oscars on the shelf. They want to go continue to entertain and to make movies and maybe to or won Tonys on stage. It's like, okay, but I still want to entertain. And so I like your attitude of saying that's fine, you know, that the trophies, you've got the right attitude. Again, that I'm not looking for that to give me something other than, well, I've done that and I can check off that box, but I still want to continue to entertain. So that's a great attitude.
Well, I think it came from, you know, when I started my dive back, my goal, there was a big competition at the Magic Circle called the Young Magician of the Year. And you may have heard of it because Johnny Hart was the first winner and made it quite famous. And it was almost a 4-year journey. You know, that was my goal, to win that competition. And all the stars aligned. The act was great on the day. And what happened was, is that I didn't win first, second, or third. And I was absolutely heartbroken. I, you know, it was so much time and effort I'd got into that. And, you know, that was the first time I'd really felt down, I guess, and didn't know what to do. And, nearly wanted to stop altogether. And you know, took some time, but I had good friends around me that helped me understand what was important and where to go from there. And you know, that was the last time I really took a competition result seriously. I would say that, you know, that enabled me, looking back, to now take them with a pinch of salt. And I think that helps me prepare for competitions, because
knowing that you could lose,
knowing that the result doesn't matter, genuinely. You know, people have won competitions and had short careers, and people have won competitions and done great things. You know, it doesn't, people have lost competitions and have gone on to great things. The result doesn't matter. And the most important, it's not under your control, right? So it just taught me all I can focus on is do the best act I can. And it sort of takes that weight off your shoulders once you realize that. You know, of course, it's tough to say, to think it doesn't matter when you've prepared and invested so much into preparing. But if you can genuinely get to that point, which I feel I have recently, where actually, you know, I don't mind about the result. I just want to create something, treat it as a deadline and that I can work towards, and, you know, create an act that can go somewhere else. I think it's made me healthier mentally and also, you know, meant that I don't really parade the awards, as you know, you might do it.
Right. No, I understand. You've answered my unasked question, and that was, how did you deal with rejection? And it sounds like that you did, and you recognized it, moved on, and then have a great attitude as to future competitions, win or lose, that it's not going to devastate you as it did that first time.
I think it takes time. I mean, I was very lucky to have a good group, you know, good family and people around that helped me. Just with the magic and focus on new things. But I think ultimately, you know, it's very easy to say, don't take it too seriously. But I know, you know, if I'd have told myself that all those years ago, I still would have cared just as much. And I think that's part of it. You know, you have to sort of go through it in a way to realize it doesn't matter, you know. So it's one of those funny things. But I think it helps to at least be aware that, you know, people forget when you don't win. And you're the only one that really remembers it.
Great advice. Great advice. Well, Edward, thank you very much for your time here today. You know, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, and I always like to close asking my guests, what is it that's your philosophy of life? Basically, what is your magic word? Not necessarily a word, it could be a phrase. You know, what is it you live by? What is your mantra? What's important to you?
I think generally is just try and be positive, focus on the thing, you know, be grateful for the things that you have. And I think, especially in magic, try and be kind. You know, it's a very small world, and I've been lucky to have, you know, heroes of mine that become good friends and mentors, and I've always tried to give back where I can and help others, help young magicians. And, you know, I think the world has an amazing way of giving back that kindness eventually, but it's just I think it's just the right way to be, you know. Certainly
be kind.
Enjoy helping others. And I think, we will enjoy others helping us, don't we? So
we do. Well, Edward, thank you again. That those good words to live by then as well. So for the Magic Word Podcast and from London, England, I thank you very much again for being my guest. That was Edward Hilsum, and this is Scotty out. Thank you again, Edward, for being my guest and for the good conversation and the good advice that you had given. I hope that the listeners will all take this to heart. There's a lot of really great information in there. So thanks again, and I look forward to our next conversation that hopefully we'll get to talk with each other live and in person sometime soon. Before I close out today's podcast, there is one event that's coming up that I think that you would be interested in viewing. This is a live event called Live with Simon Lovell, hosted by Lee Hathaway, coming up on Sunday, September the 6th of 2020. The beginning time will be at 2:30 London time, which is going to be 9:30 Eastern time, 8:30 for Central time. And you can figure it out from there, basically. But this is going to be a live event and talking with Simon Lovell. And if you want to sign up or get more information on that, I would suggest that if you just go to givingmagic.co.uk, then you can find out some information there. You can get signed up to be on the list, so that way they'll send you a link when the time has come. But Simon is someone who that we all love and respect and are hoping for his best recovery. He is someone who has been a guest here on The Magic Word in previous years, but kind of hard to get hold of in the most recent years. And I often will get some emails or text messages, or occasionally when I see people live that they will say, hey, what have you heard from Simon, or can you get in touch with him? And I have spoken with him once or twice over the phone, but it's always difficult to try to have a long and meaningful conversation. So I know that this ought to be really great that Lee Hathaway is going to facilitate. He's the one who had actually helped me to speak with Simon over the mobile phone in the past to have the conversations we have had most recently. But this should be fairly and thoroughly complete, and I'm really looking forward to that. And again, if you'll just skip over there to that website at givingmagic.co.uk, it will give you all the info that you need. I'm looking forward to this event, and I'm sure you are too. So I mentioned at the first of the podcast that we wanted to give away two autographed copies of Master of Deception, which was the new book written by John Ivan Palmer and was about his father, Jack Pyle. And we had our conversation with him a couple of weeks ago and first started that contest. Well, we had several people, several dozens of people who had entered the contest, but there are only two copies that are going to be awarded, and both are autographed copies and direct from the printer. And so those should be going out to the two winners. And so the names of the winners are Wayne Taylor and Ted Mashal. Thank you guys very much for entering the contest, and I hope that you enjoy reading your autographed copy of Master of Deception. Well, we've got a lot of stuff coming up over the next few weeks, and I know that you're going to enjoy the guests that I have. And in order to keep up with who I am having from week to week and who's going to be coming up, and also some suggestions from the archives, plus other great things that are going on then right now, I suggest that you subscribe to our weekly pod letter. It is just a little thing that comes into your e-box, your mailbox, your e-box each week, and that pod letter will give you some great information. All you have to do is go to themagicwordpodcast.com, and there you can subscribe to the pod letter, and that's all you need to do. Easy enough. Well, listen, thank you guys again for tuning in each week. And so until next week, stay well, get booked, and be positive and be grateful for what you have as you give back kindness. This is Scotty out.